I was four. I had a lot over a mile to walk. Hobnail boots. Oh, don't wonder I've got bad feet now. Got to this school, and my stepsister, she just handed me over, and there was this governess, Mrs. Ransom. She lived with her husband there. Buck teeth, huge woman. Now, I was only a tiny child, I was down there. My sister just took herself off. I was crying bitterly. I didn't know what had happened. They'd just taken me away from mother and nobody had said anything. And I didn't know what was happening. And this creature got hold of me, held me out. She said, "What's all this about?" I hear it every time I go past. I hung on the end of her arm like a rabbit, like, just like that. "Well, soon put a stop to this," she says. And that was my introduction to school. And it came dinner time. I didn't know what was going to happen, no school dinners. But my stepsister, she was at school here, you see. So she picked me up on the way and dragged me home. Marlard again, grabbed a dinner, back we came again. So I used to walk over 4 miles a day when I was 4 years old. Well, I liked school, but I learned very quickly. I was precocious, I think, when I look back on it now. And all I heard was, "We can't do anything with her." And nobody told me why. And if they hit me, mother used to say, "Well, you deserved it," or they wouldn't do it. You see, you were there to be taught. And I wanted to learn and understand. They didn't explain anything to you. And then they shunted me out of this class, past that one, I went to the next. And that's how it went on. And then I was supposed to go in this other lady's class. I was dying to go into her class, Miss Bradley. She was so lovely. Hauled me in front of the governess's desk again. Discussed me over my head. "Oh, we can't do anything with her. She'll have to go in Miss Ball's class." And I never did know why they couldn't do anything with me, but I used to soak up knowledge like a sponge. There wasn't enough for me to learn. And this little boy, being round the lavatories, the earth closet, you know, he was crying and crying, and he had messed his trousers. So me having babies I don't look after, poor little thing, I said, "All right, I'll clean you up." So I suppose I found some newspaper and cleaned him up as best I could. We had nowhere to wash our hands or anything. And I went back into the class and I was late. The lesson had started. This vast woman, cousin of the governess, she descended on me. She got a pointer. Big that end. "Just what I've been waiting for. Hold your hand out." And I started to explain to her. I said, "I'm sorry." And I remember I got that. I said, "Albie Plum messages. I don't want to hear anything about Albie Plum. You're late coming back. Hold your hand out." And she stung me, that hand. I wonder she hadn't broken it. Unmercifully. Unmercifully. And she hurt my pride as much as she hurt my hand. And she said, "Go and stand at the back of the class with your back to everybody until it's time to go home." And they were boys at the back, and in those days it was a disgrace for a girl to be mixed up with the boys. That's incredible, but it's true. But these boys were gentlemen. They didn't laugh, but they daren't sympathise, and there I had to stand. Well, I went home broken-hearted, but mother wouldn't take it up. She should have done, she wouldn't. And I know exactly where I sat. I'd been to see the place where I sat, and it was going to be an examination. I was supposed to find out my potential. I don't know. I had a lovely sheet of paper, just like that, and a pen with an inkwell sunk in the desk. I'd never had a pen or ink, and I'd never had a piece of writing paper. And I looked at this paper, and it was January the 1st, 1905. And I had to put the date up the top there. They said it was the beginning of a year. And I'd got to put January the 1st, 1905.
What did you written on before, if I can just break in?
Nothing.
The
questions were here.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, they were there.
How had you learnt to write?
On a slate and pencil.
Oh, that's it. That was the difference. This was your first piece of paper.
My first piece of paper and my first pen and first ink. And at home, you couldn't afford stationery on 10 shillings a week to keep 7 or 8.
No.
And they didn't write letters. And to the joy of this, I often think about it now because I have so much time for thinking. And I do use a lot of stationery, not as much as I did. Now I can't see, but I did. But to sit and see a piece of clean writing paper without a mark on it and a pen and some ink, that was simply beautiful as far as I'm concerned. And you see, I didn't want to mess this lovely piece of paper up. And I didn't really know how to use this pen and ink, to be quite honest. I'd never seen one. Mm. I don't know where Mother kept hers, but I hadn't seen one. And I can remember the teacher coming round and seeing what I was doing. I'd got my questions there, because I'd read when I was four. And she said, you've got to put the date at the top. And I said, what's the date? I didn't know what the date was.
There was a ferry boat to go over the river, and which my grandfather owned, and I would be about, well, ever since I can remember, he used to put people over the river, and it used to be a penny per person, and we used to punt this river boat across, which weren't very wide in them days.
But more if you had a bike?
Yes, tuppence then, you see. And people had to cycle. There was no cars, you see.
What was the road like then?
Cottenham Side, it was gravel. All fen drove and that. And Wilburton was harder. Mm. And I walked to Wilburton School 2.5 miles mornings.
It's a long old way.
We had a packed lunch. Mm. Of course, we didn't get no milk or hot drink. We had to go to the pump and have cold water. And I used to walk home nights. But I'm afraid I didn't go much in the winter time.
Was there a lot of traffic? I mean, you said you had to ferry them across.
No, only people, if they was going to visit relations, you know, each side to a farm. There was a few farmhouses in the fen. No, horses and carts to do the work. You see, there was no tractors. And you see people ploughing and that. My grandfather lived at the pub, which he
had that built, didn't he?
His father, so it'd be my great-grandfather, I think. Mm. My dad was born there, and I was born in the little white cottage just by the river.
That's the other side of the road now, isn't it?
Yes, well, it's white now. In them days, it belonged to Mr. Camps at Wilburton. Mm. And I lived there until I went to live at Cambridge, and Mum and Dad then moved to Wilburton.
Where did they get the custom from the pub? It must have been a very lonely place, was it?
Well, it probably one or two from the outlying houses, you see, came nights, and it was an Iron Cope's house, you see.
Free house, you see,
and my grandfather or my dad used to go and fetch the beer in barrels from Wilburton Station every so often.
Don't shake it about that, I think.
Yes, and when the water came up in the winter, the house we lived in, if it was high water, the water washed the end of the house.
Yes,
we could look at our bedroom window and see the water.
Did it come in the house?
In the cellar. We had a cellar, and it used to come in there. And I always remember once Mother going down the cellar, and the water had risen in the night, and she got in it.
Because since you've lived there, you were telling me that it's had, one famous owner, hasn't it?
Oh, yes, Lennon Satch, he had.
Good old days.
Yes, long good old days, yes, but...
Well, but the name 20 pence, I mean, was that the toll price? Did it ever get to 20 pence, or...
Well,
was it known as 20 pence when you
yes,
were born?
Yes, it was always named as 20 pence, and I think in years gone by, before the fen was drained. It was from Wilburton Hill to Cottenham. You see, the church at Cottenham stands on a bit of a hill.
Yes, it does.
I think that's the saying, as I can remember, that it was 20 pence from Wilburton Hill to Cottenham if anyone wanted to be
Ferry de Cross. That would have been quite a journey, wouldn't it?
It would be a distance of 5 miles, you see. It's the 2.5 to 20 pence from Wolburton and another 2.5 up to Cottenham. So I suppose in them days there weren't many people that used it, because this would be a way back years, I suppose.
Now, I mean, you've driven along that road and see it now. I mean, has it spoilt it, would you say, with this modern complex, which is now the 20 pence?
Well, in them days, there was a lot of trees, which have all been cut down and that, and it's very open and that, and you think of it as it was then, and then you think of it now as being that much modern, I think. That's the thing. I mean to say, my great-aunt, she lived just up the road, and she had an old donkey and cart, and if we got a ride with her home from the village when we'd been to school, we thought it was marvellous, you know. Or in a man's cart that was, tumble cart, that was going to the station to fetch something, you see. We used to clamber in and think, oh, we hadn't got a horse.
Walking 2.5 miles, I mean, by the time you got to school, you must have been fairly tired anyway, or were you tougher, do you think?
Like, well, I don't know, we were perhaps tough.
Mm. What time would you set out in the morning?
Oh, just after 8, or before, by 8. Mm. And we wouldn't get home till gone 5, and not then if we didn't hurry.
Were you a big family?
No, I had 2 sisters and a brother. My brother was that much younger than us, you see.
And your father, he...
He worked for his father, you see, and his father kept the pub and had some land in those days.
Oh, well, we used to race on grass.
Yeah?
All the villages, we was professionals.
Did you really?
Yeah.
And did you used to go to other places?
Yes, been all over England.
Well, and you say you race on grass. I mean, that isn't just flat grass, is it?
Or... Yeah. I had a brother, you see. He was born with club feet right round. Hmm. And he was in hospital 2.5 years. He went in Addenbrookes and he never done him any good. So Mum just took him out and took him to London, Westminster Orthopaedic Hospital. And they broke his legs, got his feet straight in 6 months so as he could walk. Hmm. And then the 1914 war started, but he finished up one of the best riders in the country.
Did he really?
Yes.
What was his name? His Christian name?
William.
William Sennett, yeah.
Yeah.
But one thing that, I mean, you're telling me about this grass track racing. I mean, I was born not many miles from here in Chatteris. You've heard of Chatteris, have you?
Yeah.
But they don't actually... Chatteris people think
they know everything.
Well, that's very true.
And they think they can work better than anybody. Well, they can work a lot on them, but...
But they don't have... They never have grass racing in Chatteris, isn't it?
Some raced there years ago.
Did you?
Yeah.
Well, I've never heard of it.
March.
Yeah?
I always rid well at March. Me and my brother went there, I think it was Whitmundy.
Mm.
That was after the war finished. And he got 6 first. I got 5 seconds and a third.
Did you really?
Yeah.
What kind of prizes would you pick up for winning these titles?
Well, up to £3, but some places, they varied, like you see. You go to Carmarthen and some place up Yorkshire, there wouldn't there be £30.
Yeah. But, I mean, you say you race. Would you race around in a circle or
yes,
a figure of eight?
Yes, miles, half miles, 3 miles, quarter miles.
As I say, I've lived in this area 30 years and I never knew this went on. I mean...
Well, damn it, of course it did.
Well, you've certainly enlightened us today.
I raced at Chatteris when all the best riders in the country was there. There were 2 Horns, 2 Chambers, 2 Southalls, And those bloody dirtiest riding going, fetching each other off. Yeah.
You had to be fairly tough then.
Yes, it was. And you see, we race for money, well, where's money as fiddles.
Yes.
You see, there'd be 3 or 4 on your sharing.
But how can you fiddle racing on a bike? I mean, do you mean you just slow up?
But you'd have bookies.
Oh.
Or there'd be 4 sharing, there'd be 2 losing, and they'd be getting a better mark. Well, that was all right while they agreed. You see, and then when the 2 got up front, they started winning, you see. But, you see, we had betting too.
And Could you bet on yourself?
Yeah, you used to fiddle it so bookies didn't know, you see. Once you got up North Lincolnshire and Yorkshire up there, you see, they had proper registered bookies. But round here, they used to have anybody. Oisland was the last professional meeting. Well, they used to have 7,000 people there on the telly Thursday.
Are you?
Yeah.
Well, what are you doing on the telly on Thursday?
Don't you read a local paper?
The beep. Yes, I actually do. I know what
you... Well, you didn't read it, do you? Read about me.
That is you, isn't it? Well, do you know, I read about it. The man from Wiccan on bygones.
Yeah.
That's must be very used to being interviewed then.
Well, I've been on the telly 20 times.
Have you?
Well, if they count them all up.
Yeah.
Well, that was a block of peat.
Yeah, you're digging out a block
of peat, and of course that ain't dry.
No.
But, you cut that up in the blocks.
Yeah.
Put it down, put some decoy ducks down.
Yeah.
And, set fire to them blocks, and the smoke attracts the ducks. And, of course, you know they have little dogs trained to drive them into the nets.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Well, what the man does, he'll get a block of peat and set fire to it, and when it's smoulder, of course, that don't flare, and he rubs it all over himself.
Yeah.
Because a duck is like a dog. It's got the
sense of smell.
Of, like a dog.
Has it really? I never knew that.
So they rub this here over them, and that takes him and sent away.
How long does a piece of peat, how long would that burn, if you know?
Well, that depends on the fire.
How did they used to dredge it? Can you tell us what machines they used to use?
We had a grab dredger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and... We used to take it out, you see. I mean, being the driver, you see, you started right again the bank, but you hadn't got to make it very deep there. When you got into the depth they really want, for talking sake, if they want 10 feet of water, that'd be in the middle of the river, but you'd got to make it on the slope so the wash didn't float into the river, so it didn't come down in the river. And when we was up the Whissy, we had to straighten out again what they call the 5 mile bridge, because there's a terrible bend in there. Then after that river got done, they opened a gold pit right just above the bridge, right straight over where the Whissy factory is now. Well, that clay was put in barges, and we'd got perhaps another dredger unloading these barges on the banks, you see. And the same a thing applied for the Roswell pits at Ely. That they had drag lines there loading the clay into barges, and they used to bring it up to the Lark. I was up the Lark some of the time with the dredger, unloading these barges. Well, them barges hold about 50 ton of clay, and we used to unload 6 of them a day.
How fast would these barges have moved up the river? Was it?
They had to be pulled up there with a diesel tug. They towed them up the river, you see. And same as when they'd done the little ooze, that was just the same. And they'd have these big barges on the front of the tug, and on the back they'd have 4 or 6 shallow barges to take up Leighton Heath Lewis, because there wasn't so much water in there, so you had to have the load's lighter to get up the load.
So really, the whole process really was robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Yeah, really. That's right. Yeah. That's how that was done. And
did you ever know? Because I mean, you mentioned several rivers there.
Yeah.
So you must have got around the area a fair bit. Did you never know which river you were working on?
Well, you wouldn't be sure. I mean, for talking sake, I started up the Whissy. Well, when we came down from the Whissy...
Which runs between where? Can
that,
you explain?
That runs between Stoke Ferry and Hilgie. That come out just below Ouse Bridge on the main river. And we had to pull out the Whissy one night. We got to Hilgie Bridge. And when we got to Hilgie Bridge, we couldn't get under the bridge. You see, I got the jib down, but you got to blow your boiler out and put the shear legs up to get your boiler lower down into the bottom of the boat to get underneath the bridge. We got down there one night at 12 o'clock, blew the boiler out, and you never heard so much noise as all the dogs in Hilgi woke up with and started barking. Yeah, that's how it were down there. Mm. We had a houseboat with us. We could stop the night on there. We could sleep on the houseboat because we got all spring mattresses in the houseboat and flock mattresses and blankets on there. And all, you see, all this stuff would be on there. We used to do all the cooking. There was a cooking stove in there, cook all your food. But, I mean, if you want bacon and eggs in the morning for breakfast, well, you could have it because you put the pan on. Yeah, and you see, when we was up these rivers, at night, if we hadn't got nothing else much to do, what we used to do was, if there's any rabbits about there, we'd take the old gun out and shoot a rabbit and skin that like for a meal the next day, which I have done many a time. Yeah.
Now, the dredger itself, which is like a big crane, yes?
Yeah, yeah.
That has to sit on a rare apparatus, doesn't it, to keep it floating?
That's right. That's in a big pontoon, the dredger is. And as I said, the smaller dredgers was... All the machinery was on the middle pontoon, and the two pontoons on the side, you see, was to balance it as you swung your jib around. That rock about a bit, but that's how it worked,
Well, but did you ever find anything interesting? I mean, obviously you were ploughing deep into the river.
Yes,
yes. You must have brought some stuff up.
when Fowler was here over the beet factory, he came to me. I found three or four old pots. That was more of a rough pot they were. And some of them had got a little tiny short handle on. He said there was more historical pots, what they had for drinking or eating out of, you see. And anyway, he's quite interested in that. Or that time of day, I mean, he'd perhaps give us 15 shillings to a pound of these pots. Some of them went into the college in Downing Street at Cambridge. And one night, when I was up the Lark, I was sleeping there like on the houseboat then, and a fellow what I was friendly with, where we used to go to the farm, you see, we used to go to the farm and get our milk for tea and all like that. Well, he'd come there, Jim, he said, I got ploughed a skeleton of a man out. He'd been ploughing deep for celery, you see. With ordinary corn and that, they don't go so deep as what they did for celery. And he found this skeleton. He said, what you got to do with it? I said, take it home, some major fella can come and have a look at it. So I give him a ring up when I got back, and he come. He said, do you mind, he said to the wife, if we put this on your little kitchen table, which we did, to fix him up. There was only one or two like finger bones or feet bones missing. Anyway, he was quite pleased with it, and he took it away. He said, I'll let you know all about it. And I think it went on for about a week or so, and I think he gave me a pound then for the, which I took back to my mate up there, and we shared the money up between us.
Of course, I was born in Soham at the mill house in 1910. I have a brother who is older and a sister who is older. My brother is dead. He's dead 3 years. My sister's still alive, married and lives at Fordham. And her husband is a farmer and supplies milk to the village and so on. But my earliest recollections, of course, are that early in my life, I do remember the outbreak of the 1418 war, and although a very child, its implications meant nothing to me really, but I remembered lots of uniform and so on in and around, both at the mill and in the street and so on. And I would think that that was not a part that impressed my life very much. Of course, during the 1418 war, I was very unfortunate inasmuch as I contracted diphtheria. And diphtheria was a very serious disease in those days. And I had a Dr. Corey in Sarum here, was our medical advisor, and he called in Dr. Beckett from Ely, and they performed an operation on me in the mill house by lamplight, with no anaesthetics and so on and so forth. And this operation proved to be successful, and I lived under the cloud of diphtheria for about 6 weeks before I was properly recovered. Anyway, that's some of my earliest recollections, would be about in the mill at 6 o'clock in the morning and work pretty solidly hard physically until 8:30, go home and have breakfast and then change and come out into the office and become an office and administering executive director for most of the day, and then of course after tea I went to working clothes again, and lorries were unloaded and loaded up and so on. And so we really did a very hard day's job of work, and the staff were exceedingly willing to work with us. And then the 1939 war came, and it was a case of great activity. Mills in the ports were bombed and came into ruins, and we were called upon to work day and night, Saturdays, Sundays. And in one particular year, we started this steam engine, which was still working, although it had been modified once or twice. It was still working very well. And we cleaned the boiler, which was customary at Christmas. And when the boiler was fired again, it was steam up. The wheels never stopped turning until the Easter of that year. So it was 3 months non-stop, every day and night of the of each week until Easter, when we cleaned the boiler again. And so we did a tremendous war effort in making flour, which of course for a large quantity of the flour then, making biscuits, went for ship's biscuits and army biscuits and the like. And we were very, very much in demand for all we could produce.
Because of the size of your buildings, you had to have the mills camouflaged.
They were camouflaged in 1939. They were done by Kerridge, the builders at Cambridge. And they went all round, and it looked a pretty ugly situation to look at. It wasn't a nice creeper-covered
colour.
Red brick building that it used to be. It was just blotted out with weird shapes, rather like the ships on the sea were. And I wouldn't say that I was very impressed favourably with it, although it may or may not have been the means of us escaping any bombs or not. We shall never know. But of course, we did have at the end, towards the end of the war, this frightful train accident in Sarum, in which some railway men were killed when an ammunition train exploded, or the one truck exploded.
On the 2nd of June 1944, the mill had had a narrow escape from destruction when a wagon of an ammunition train passing through Sarum was found to be on fire. Despite efforts of the railway staff, two of whom lost their lives, the contents of the wagon exploded, doing considerable damage to the town of Sarum. The railway station was destroyed, and the mill suffered a damage which caused it to stop running for 2 days.
There was a national subject in the papers and so on, and of course I was in Sarum at the time, and it was quite phenomenal, the things that happen when an explosion of such magnitude goes off. I believe the actual quantity was 44 bombs weighing 500 pounds each, all went off in one go. It seemed a pretty long time. At 2 o'clock in the morning, I thought it was never going to end.
It wasn't just one great big bang then, it was a succession.
No, they were going off one after the other, you see, these 44 bombs. They were just going on and on, one after the other, and it seemed to last for about half a minute. Well, I looked out of the bedroom window and the gasworks was on fire, which was close to the railway, and we thought it was a bomb on the gasworks, really. We didn't realise what was going through. It was a whole trainload of bombs.
Because it did terrible damage to many hundreds of houses, didn't it?
Oh, lots of houses, yes. The roofs were off and gable ends were blown in, and the devastation was pretty considerable.
And the mill didn't escape either?
No, it did not escape. It got a certain amount of damage. The worst part of the damage, unfortunately, was the steam engine in the mill. It became... it had delicate moving parts in it, and those delicate parts were broken, and the mill stopped for about 3 days to have urgent repairs done, and then we were away again. It was really a very big item in the affairs of not only the parish, but of the mill and everybody living here at that time.
Oh, we had no water, you see. And every time we came home from school, there's a broomstick waiting. When the next one got a bit bigger, we had to go right across the common and fetch a bucket of water on a broomstick between us. So I had to do that, and I had to help with the dusting and do errands. But I never played. That was the only time I played at school, and it was lovely. And then it came time, I was 13. Wanted to be a school teacher. Oh, I did want to be a school teacher. And I had to... They counted up your attendances, you see. And they got my certificate with the bygones here. Anita Brown has. Well, they counted up your attendances. And if you'd made so many attendances, you left. It didn't matter whether you could work or whether you could, if you'd made enough attendances. They'd counted mine up, and I had. And I had to leave. And Miss Teague, she sat there, she was a headmistress, she sat there at her desk. And she said, I'm afraid you've got to leave. And I broke my heart. It broke my heart. Prior to that, she had asked my mother and father if I could sit for a scholarship for Ely High School. Uh-huh. We had trains then, plenty of trains. You could go by train and back. There were three other girls and me, we were picked out, and she came down on the common, which was unheard of for anybody like her to come on our common. There were a lot of roughs there. She came and saw my parents and to see if I could sit for this scholarship, so she could just sail through it, because I heard it all. You could hear everything in the house. And father didn't believe in you going above your station in life. Mother said, well, she's got to earn her keep, we can't keep her. And this teacher, this schoolmistress, she really did plead with my mother and father. She said it was criminal to let it go, 13, and go to service, which there was no alternative, that or land work. Mm. And I can always remember she said she could end up with help at Newnham. Oh, Newnham. What's Newnham? Who's Newnham? That was another thing for me. I've always been chasing words. And so... they flatly said no, it was out of the question. And the other three girls, they went to Ely High School, because that was a marvellous school then, Ely High School was. And I used to go and carry the books for one of them if she'd speak to me a little bit in French. Mother hit me, used to hit me for it. She said, you could have been where she is. I said, why didn't you let me go then? So that was that. So I had to go off to service when I was 13. Because I was quite happy with these Hobbs people. They treated me.
And what was their business?
Corn merchants. But they didn't treat me like a maid. I was like a daughter to them. And I went to chapel, loved my chapel, and I was in the choir. And Mrs. Hobbs, she used to go to this chapel, and she'd evidently set her mind on having me. And what she wanted, she always had. My time was my own after tea, but I didn't want it, because I didn't want to go home. And I loved being in the shop, and I loved being with him. He'd be sitting at the desk, as a high stool, it's still there, I've been and looked. And he couldn't read or write. and he was a rich man, but he couldn't read or write. They taught him just to sign a cheque, the boys had. And so I say, can I come in the shop tonight, please, Mr. Hobbs? And if anybody very important was coming, he'd say, not tonight, my girl. I was always his girl. And other times, there'd be quite a lot of people come in, and I was one of them, but I always stood back by the corn bins. Then he'd refer to me, draw me in the conversation. He'd say, you ask my girl, she'll tell you. You know, it was really, I loved them. And I didn't care what I did. I didn't care a bit what I did. And she treated me well, but it was him I liked.
Was Salem a wealthy place then, would you say? Or was it, they, when I say
they,
wealth,
it was cut as clean in halves as that. And they were rich, the rich, and the poor were the poorest dregs of the earth.
Now, here we are at Addison House. Mrs. Ford, who is with us in the car, has kindly offered to come into the picture of the survey of Soham, of things past, things present, are there for everybody to see. And Mrs. Ford's residence in Soham is part of the establishment which her father had and extends from here on the main road right back to the moat house and the gardens with it, which of course are opposite to the mill on the other side of the river. Now, we're very pleased to see you, Mrs. Ford. Well, I think we'd like to know what are your memories of Soham, particularly those in the earlier years.
Well, I mean, the place is totally different when it was a little village, and I mean, we knew everyone in it.
Oh, yes.
Didn't we?
We did.
And now, what is it? Over 6,000?
Yes, that's right.
And they come and they go, and we don't know them at all.
Yes, I'm afraid
but,
so.
But it is, and it's so built up,
oh, yes.
Roger, from
yes.
what it used to be,
it
isn't
is.
It?
Yes.
Fresh estates on either side of the main road, you know.
Like Mr. Clark, were you born in Soham?
Yes.
And have lived here all your life?
Yes.
In the moat? At the moat house?
I was born at the moat house.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yes, it was just before we left to go to Beechhurst.
Yes. Yes.
Why was it called the moat house?
Well, because there was a moat
there was
around
a moat,
it.
Yeah. Well, I knew that it was the obvious, but...
Yes, yes, there was. And now that house was built by my father, and it was bought from Baird, you know, the squire,
Abingdon
Baird,
yes.
And all the land round it as well. Mm. And before he had it, of course, it was Squire Meredith. And it was through him that we didn't have the railway junction that they have now at Ely. Yeah. It was through him that it wasn't put in Soham.
Is that so?
Yes.
How interesting.
Yes, I got that from John Cow some time ago.
Oh, yes.
And,
What was life like living at the big house, Beechhurst?
Very comfortable.
Was
bags of room.
Yes. But we were a large family, you know. There were five of us.
Because now, of course, it is the school.
Just the school now.
Newer buildings have been added on.
Yes.
But it hasn't spoilt the look of the house, has it?
No. No, I think on the whole it hasn't. And they keep the grounds up well, too, which is rather a joy.
What's the biggest, you were mentioning at the beginning of this interview, the things that you had seen change and so on, but if you took stock of everything that has gone, what's the biggest change you think you've seen in Soham itself?
Well, it is the more people coming in and, I don't know, the people change.
They change, yeah.
Mm. Oh, they do, yes. Tremendously.
Do you think
so much coming and going?
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
Do you think there's still a community spirit there in the town, or do you think that it has lost it, or it's in danger of losing that community spirit?
No, I think not, really. No, I think there is a community spirit. Yes.
Well, of course, we're sitting in front of your house in Mr. Clark's car.
Yes.
And it's very busy at the moment. And of course, you're going to hopefully have a little bit of peace when the...
We are indeed.
The bypass.
And it should come next spring.
Yes, for another year from now, yes.
Our house, you know, is very old.
Mm.
And when we lived at Beechhurst, my aunt was living here. And then it did belong to my father, this house. And he modernised it, and we came here when all the family had gone, except myself.
Because your father was in racing, is that correct?
He was, yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? He knew Fred Archer, I believe.
Oh, yes. Now, he was a great friend of my father's. But I know he was... used to come over to the Moat House a lot because my mother has said so. And my mother liked him very much too.
Your father being in the racing industry, did he ever... why did he remain in Soham? I mean, did he... because his roots were here? I'm thinking in terms of Newmarket. Did he ever have longings to go there?
I don't think so. He went there when he was a boy, when he had run away from school, and went to Mr. Peter Price, who, trained him, really, ride.
He was a jockey?
Yes, but not for very long.
No, but what time would we be talking about now, roughly?
Well, about 18... 95, would it be, Roger?
That's about it, I should think, yes.
About that.
I wasn't a witness to it.
Before Lester Pickett's time.
Yes. Yes, well before that. When they used to ride with long stirrups.
Did they?
Yes, in those days, just ordinary long stirrups, didn't they?
They straight
and
down.
And no goggles or masks or anything, hats, nothing like that at all.
So they were a great deal tougher, you would say? You'd have to be.
Oh, yes, you would have to be, undoubtedly.